When you think about capital, capital itself also has no face, has no smell. How do you think in artistic terms, when you think today, how to depict or portray capital and give it a human face?
I mean, the stereotype of the expressionist theatre would be a man in a top hat and a big cigar with a fat belly. But of course, it's the opposite now. They are the leanest, most diet conscious people, the fittest people on the planet, because they know the havoc they've caused for everyone else, so they're determined to stay fit. I mean, there are areas where you can go where you see these people, areas in London, in all the capital cities, in the expensive parts of the world. It's not about bad people, it's about a rotten system. And I'm not sure it needs a human face. We just have to understand how it works.
Most of your characters or your stories, we obviously like, they are normal people. They are struggling with usually forces that are much beyond their control, that sometimes they're not even aware of it. But of course, in your films, you see these forces looming around. So basically, it would be like by the struggle of the people, how they perceive this power.
Well, for us, it's about explaining the logic of capital, because it has its own logic. If a big company doesn't make a profit, the people who invest in it will take their money and put it elsewhere, so the company will fail. So they have to make a profit. Competition demands that the way they make a profit is through cutting their labour costs. It's the working class then that pays, because the labour costs are cut, either through fewer workers or through lower wages or worse conditions. I think the only way we've tried to do it is to explain the logic of the system, the logic of the system that actually is destroying people. And if you understand the logic, then you can start to undermine it and see its weaknesses and how you can change it.
There was this Russian poet, Joseph Brodsky, who used to not only say but insist in the idea that we, as human beings, we make aesthetic choices before ethical ones. It's always, arguably a matter of how people perceive things first with their guts and so on before they can make any moral judgment or even their own mind. How would this affect your art making, your filmmaking?
I think it's what you're drawn to, which comes out of your, I guess, predisposition, comes out of your early experiences, and what you're drawn to, and what you just find intuitively interesting, and the images that you want to find. That's to do with the kind of people you want to photograph and the situations they're in and the conflicts they're in and the emotions they go through and the world around them.
Personally, did you have a kind of a illumination or a discovery of how things work?
Well, it's a process. I'm sure it's the same for everybody. You start out with family experiences, school experiences, memories of childhood. I mean, my father's family were coal miners, and he was one of 10 children, and they lived in there were 10 children in a tiny terraced house, and they kept pigs in the back garden because they'd been farm labourers before they were coal miners. And that tradition, that, very basic working class condition, are memories that like all of us, you feed on your childhood memories, and that's part of it. Part of it was the town where I grew up, which was a small industrial town in the Midlands. This is the 1940s, 1950s, and it was during the war when people had a huge sort of connection with each other. In the middle of the night, you would be in your neighbour's garden in a shelter from the bombs. All those images of, people's solidarity, good neighbours, people sticking together. They're the things that, because they happen when you're young, that's what's in your mind all the time. We used to go to holiday once a year to a place called Blackpool. It was very much where the working class went on holiday. And the comedy, every night you would go and see a different set of comics. So that comedy and the audience collapsing with laughter. So, these are the things you draw on, I guess this is what is, these things you draw on. And then out of that, then you arrive at political ideas through later experience, I suppose.
Was it a big shift when you went to Oxford?
Well, in some ways it was, in some ways it wasn't. I mean, I'd done 2 years, we all had to do 2 years national service in the armed. I had to be in the Air Force for 2 years as a typist. And then after that, I went to university. So I was older then. And we felt, we'd grown up in those 2 years from 19 to 21. So we weren't like today's students in some ways. And I'd lost the capacity to do academic work. And I'd done a lot of theatre work in different ways, amateur theatre work. And I did that at university. And I was meant to study law, but I didn't study law. We did put on plays all the time. So in that, it was a continuity. But what was different was seeing real wealth at Oxford, which I'd never seen. It was nothing like it in the town I lived in. I mean, it was a kind of respectable, some poorer people, some not poor, like we weren't poor, but most people were working class at one level or another. At Oxford, there were men, young men there who knew they would rule the world. And they did. You know, and they went into the law, and they went into business, or they went into politics. You saw them rise, you know. And when they were 20, 21, 22, they had the big sports cars, they had the smart clothes, they had the expensive girlfriends who came from London, and it was another world.